You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. James Fadiman has been professionally involved with psychedelics for more than 60 years. He developed modern microdosing, including the use of protocols, specific dose ranges, and time off. He's the author of The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide and has also written textbooks, professional books, and a self-help book, a novel, and some videos for PBS. He taught at three universities, ran his own management consulting firm, and co-founded the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology, and has served as a director of the Institute of Noetic Science. Jordan Gruber, JD, is the co-author of Your Symphony of Selves with Fadiman in 2020. He's written, ghostwritten, and edited more than a dozen books in a wide variety of fields, from forensics and finances to fitness and psychology. In the mid-1990s, he founded the Enlightenment.com website. He's also been close friends with Fadiman since 1990 and contributed to the Psychedelic Explorer's Guide. Their new book is Microdosing for Health, Healing, and Enhanced Performance. Thank you for joining me, gentlemen.
Very nice to be here.
You know, one of the things that I found interesting in this book was the approach that I think, you know, legally you guys had to take in terms of what the book was not about and telling us that from up front. So tell us why, but also what you had to say in terms of what readers should expect from this book in terms of, you know, specific doses, people, places, etc. Jim Fadiman, why don't you start?
Well, what they should expect from this book is a lot more information than they expect. Because what we're finding and reporting on is that microdosing has more uses for more health conditions and for more enhancement of performance than anyone has reported so far. That's the core of the book, which is, what is it? How does it work? How is it used? And we report on what other people speculate. We don't do much speculating ourselves. What it doesn't have, and it's important, it doesn't have a list of available illegal sites and other illegal ways to obtain it. We do make some suggestions of what people told us they've done. And it seems to be remarkably easy for most people to come by, especially in certain California coastal cities, which will go unnamed.
You know, one of the I loved about this book is how clear it was and how organized it was. And just the format of the book is essentially you'll start off, you'll state what a topic is, for example, working with others. Then you'll ask, a number of questions or present questions and present those answers. How did you come up with that format?
Well, I'll take this one. So Jim and I wrote a proposal and were rejected by a very powerful agent in Manhattan. So then we looked around and we found another agent, and his name is James Levine. He's the head of his literary agency. And when we were speaking to him, he asked Jim, "What do you do best?" And Jim said, "I answer questions best." And then Jim Levine had the brainstorm of to make this book like What to Expect When You're Expecting. So in question and answer format. And that was really a wonderful way to do it. It works really well in the audio book because people just have to hear one segment at a time and only focus on that. And it was a good way for us to write it because we weren't constrained to try to write an inverted pyramid essay or an encyclopedia treatise, things which I'm good at doing. This wasn't like that. This was, we answer each question in the best way, and there's a little bit of overlap and back and forth. And it's so it's more informal and you know, easier, user-friendly that way.
You know, I like that idea of a premise of trying to be informal. And I think you do a good job of balancing that with the, you know, answering the questions that people ask essentially about the science behind all this, which is very young. And I think one of the things I like about this book is it's an excellent example of a young subject of science, a science that is still developing. And I think it does a great job of stating what we know, what we don't know, what we have to find out, and what we are interested in, but also of giving, you know, of collecting data in the form of anecdotes from all these users who have experienced remarkable symptoms and regressions and improvements in their perceptual abilities. So talk about this is a science that essentially rose out of reports from, you know, users. Talk about, you know, taking that raw data, the anecdotes, the subjective reports of what happened, and, you know, subjecting that to your own scientific rigor. James.
Well, as I really looked at the history of science almost always with somebody having an experience, or at least a personal revelation, or they find something that they'd never seen before, starts with an individual having a genuine experience. Eventually, modern science likes to more and more eliminate the individual and eliminate the individual experience and get down to things that can be measured. And most of the important things in your life and in your mind, you will notice, are not measured. What percentage in love are you? Okay, that's obviously a question that nobody asks because it makes no sense. So we, in a sense, began where science begins. And the other end of it, if you're writing about anything useful, the real question is this safe? Is it good for me? And how do I do it best? So you come back past the science, is you're right back to human experience.
And this book does a great job of answering those questions. So, like many people, what I've heard about microdosing is microscopic. It's a microscope of the information, a microdose of the information you give us in this book, as it were. So tell us, when did microdosing start? And you have a fascinating history. There are some great people back there. A fellow who wanted to market his own LSD back in the day. So take us back to the beginnings of microdosing.
We have to go back to before there was written language, if you want to get serious, which is we see all over the world where there were plants or fungi, mushrooms, that gave people altered states, they were used. And they're still being used indigenously around the world. Modern microdosing could have begun in the 1980s with some wonderful guy in San Francisco who synthesized LSD, packaged it, and then gave it away. Unfortunately, his big 400,000 doses to give away was interrupted by the federal government. So he kind of vanished from history at that point. We rediscovered him, but only after we'd been working with microdosing for like a number of years. So it is... it's been around, and we have simply what we call modern microdosing to make sure we're not talking about indigenous microdosing. And it is becoming clearly more and more popular because it seems to help people and without harming them.
And if I may, the next part of the story is that after a 2009 breakfast in a Santa Cruz diner with a guy named Bob Forte, who told Jim about it, Jim started turning his professional psychedelic researcher mind to microdosing. So what you have to realize is that for 45 years, Jim had been in the industry looking at had been in this profession, let's say, and had no interest in these very small doses. Jim was a high stakes, high transcendence guy, and even the creativity studies they did were with moderately large doses. So nobody had any interest. But then Bob Forte said that Albert Hofmann, the person who synthesized LSD and psilocybin, was taking small doses and would walk in the woods to clarify his mind. So Jim started asking people about their experiences with microdosing and had they tried it, and they started getting reports. And based on that, he started giving talks, and word got out. And then there were reporters, and he was asked about, is it true that people are microdosing for coding in Silicon Valley? So it's sort of a positive feedback loop, or a virtuous spiral or cycle. The more that came in, the more he spoke, and the more it became known. And this signal got stronger and stronger, all the way up to the point where Ayelet Waldman wrote her book, A Really Good Day. And then Michael Pollan had Jim on How to Change Your Mind on his Netflix show. And so as we've looked more and more, we're constantly surprised by how many physical and mental health conditions it improves, and the broad range of enhanced performance from art and creativity to sports and sex.
You know, one of the things that interested me was the import of the Silicon Valley, both in the technological, scientific, coding realm, but also in the kind of artistic and creative inclinations of that community. And this the same community played a big part in the work of the late Steve Silberman, who wrote the book Neurotribes. And it strikes me that this was a good place for work that looks at our brain to get up, in a sense. Silicon Valley is a great petri dish for our mental development, technology, and just the science of looking at the human brain, which is still in its infancy. We have all of our hairs are on fire about artificial intelligence, but we do not even have a great definition of consciousness yet. So talk about the petri dish of Silicon Valley.
Well, Silicon Valley gets a lot more credit in the write-up of microdosing than is in reality. And why that's true is quite a ways back, I had a question from a reporter. I believe it was from Mother Jones, perhaps. I'm not sure. And I had a friend who was a graduate student and an inventor who said I'd be happy to talk with him. So the initial article was about one person. And the article writer said it was becoming more popular. Okay, a little bit of journalistic whoosh there. And I called him a few weeks later and he said, you know, the funny thing is, it's true that, you know, I only had that one person. But since I've done the article, a number of my friends have called me and said, hey, man, I'm microdosing too. He inadvertently exposed that people were already experimenting. And the initial bunch of articles started with his in Silicon Valley. I was getting reports already from people in England and people in Europe, so that microdosing was already on its way when it was, quote, discovered by the media.
Let's ratchet back to some basics here. What substances are primarily used for microdosing, and what do we mean by microdosing? And what are the basic, I guess, what you would call them, protocols for microdosing? Jim, I believe you invented the most used and most effective, as far as I can tell from reading the book, protocol.
Protocol is a high-end word for schedule, which is how often do you take it and how much do you take. And again, the book has the necessary detail, but basically a microdose is a tenth to a 20th of what's usually called a recreational dose. The substances, we have reports from a lot of substances, but 95% of them are either from LSD or from natural psilocybin mushrooms. So that's the substances. Protocol, the curious thing is we found out early on that taking something every day is a pharmaceutical invention. And it's realistic for pharmaceuticals because most of them suppress a symptom. And as soon as the drug is out of your body, the symptom gets a chance to return. Microdosing is exactly the opposite. Microdosing helps the body do the work. And therefore, you take it less often. Every protocol has more days off than days that you're taking. And so over the period of a month, with what's called the Fadiman protocol, it's after a month or 6 weeks, you take several weeks off. So it is used sparingly, and it's used at a low dose. And our little mantra is start low, meaning if you're going to try this, start below where you think it will have any effect to be sure that you're feeling good about it. Go slow, which is if you're going to raise the dose, do it not immediately and try the higher dose for a few days before you're comfortable and take time off. So that's, if you think of what you read on the back of your pill bottles, they don't say that. So we're not talking about a pharmaceutical. It's more similar to a vitamin.
Jürgen, one of the things I really like about this book is its sense of telling stories, both on the personal level and on the whole level of the development of what we call microdosing. I'd like you to talk about, like, corralling in that story and making it work with this what to expect when microdosing format.
Well, what you should expect is not anything very exciting.
Mm.
Ayla Waldman's book, Ayla Waldman had used like a half page on her book is all the pharmaceuticals she'd taken for her depression. And what happens with microdosing is you go to work, you maybe notice you're a little more effective, you speak up in meetings and get a little more, yes, positive feedback. You can make a few calls that you didn't want to make because you don't want to talk to those people. You're nicer to someone in your sphere of where you are, even though they don't deserve it. After work, you may go to the gym and, again, reporting, you'll have one more set of reps. And at the end of the day, I microdosed. So what it does is improve your functioning in whatever direction your functioning needs improvement. Now, if your functioning is depressed, obviously the body would rather you would not be depressed. And what people report over and over and over is that after a short round of microdosing, in many, many cases, their depression just alleviates. And what they say to us, I'm back. I feel the way I did before I started taking antidepressants.
So it's very important to realize that it's not like you're a little bit high or you're having a little bit of a psychedelic trip. It's really almost a completely different substance. And one of the ways we've been reframing it for people is that the doses that people take when they have a full-on psychedelic trip, those are a kind of overdose almost compared to the broad benefits and the safety and the ease with which you can take microdoses. So it's such a different thing. And, sometimes people want more than that. They think that if they're not having big experiences, then they're not doing enough. So when Jim started with this, he used the term subperceptual, which is an interesting term, but it's not exactly correct because most people most of the time know when they're microdosing or not. But it stays below the threshold of any kind of psychedelic trip. So you're not seeing any crazy stuff with your eyes. You're not having any extreme changes of normal consciousness. You have no problem having your ordinary day. Nobody knows that you're on anything. And most of the time, if you're properly dosed, you won't be thinking about it and go, oh, I'm microdosing. This is better. It's not like that. It just kind of fades into the background. And then what Jim also found with his protocol, his conservative protocol, is that if you're on day one and then you're off day two and off day three, day two is often the best day. People don't have any chemical load in their body. The LSD or psilocybin has left their system, but they're still feeling it. They're still aware of it. They're still having the benefits of, and we haven't talked at all about the science per se yet, but they're still in that neuroplasticity zone. They're still feeling the anti-inflammatory effects and they're still moved back towards equilibrium or homeostasis. So they are back to their normal, happy, feeling better self.
You know, one of the things that I thought was really interesting was you used a term that's kind of like a self-cleaning. It's almost like an oil change for your entire body in a sense that it helps, it helps the inner workings of your system work just a little bit better at a level that doesn't involve the perceptual aspects. And I must admit that I was one of the many people when I heard the term microdosing. Well, it's kind of like, wow, that'd be great. It'd be like tripping, but not quite. Not that I myself, I find this book really interesting because my experiences with psychedelics in the overdose, or what you call the overdose phase, have not been great. In fact, I would have sworn them off forever. Given the way you explain it in this book, it makes a lot of sense. So talk about, you know, the expectations that you have from people who are coming at this like, well, maybe it's like a little mini trip. It's absolutely not. And also, let's start to get, whoever wants to, let's talk into that scientific aspect.
Sure. Well, one of the aspects scientific is how you define things. And this is Connor Murray at UCLA. He's came up with the realization that if we think of the microdose as the correct dose, because it has the most uses, it has the best effects at the small level, it has the and it's the least problematic. And then we look indigenously and we find, of course, it's used throughout the world for as a microdose. To improve your hunting ability, to improve focus. And then he said, he's the one who realized, he says, that looks like the dose. That's the correct dose. And when you take too much, then you can't function. You have visual distortion. You also may have entities. If you're using ayahuasca, giant anacondas may come and eat you. You're reborn into another planet. That sounds like too much. So the too much is where the 60s discovered it, and now we're, in a sense, bringing it back down to what has been true throughout history. And it is beneficial in a general sense because it's improving the way the body and the mind prefer to be. It increases the capacity for healing. And that's not exciting, but it's much more important.
And in fact, one of the people who we quote is a professor named David Nutt from England. And back when we were saying microdosing seemed to work for 15 health conditions, now we're up to about 40, but back when it was 15, he said, you know, I'm a little bit suspicious about anything that could be good for so many things. But then the realization is there's a bunch of other things that are good for your whole body's functioning, like sleep and exercise. And eating well and having adequate hydration. So this idea that microdoses are more like a vitamin that makes all of you working better is where we're kind of landing now.
And this brings on an important point. Talk about the placebo effect and determining that these results are not indeed the result of what's called the placebo effect, which is quite powerful and which we don't. How much do we know about that, actually?
Well, I once was going to do a book on the placebo effect because in science at that point, everyone complained about it, which is I'm doing this terrific experiment, but then the people I don't give anything to, a lot of them get better too. And what you find is placebo is a nice word, but a much clearer one is natural healing response.
Much better word. Yeah, that's a great idea.
Much more accurate. And so the question is, does microdosing, the question early on was, well, this doesn't do much and people really feel better. Maybe it doesn't do anything at all. And it's just, you said it would make you feel better. Not an unrealistic question, a little biased, but not bad. And what we now have is a study by Connor. This is with measuring brainwaves. And it turns out that when you say to people, improve your brainwaves, that people don't do that. The system doesn't work that way. So he simply gave a very low dose or nothing. people and measured brainwave changes. The people who'd had the microdose showed the same brainwave changes that people on high doses have, except obviously a lower amplitude. The people who had nothing showed no brainwave changes, and people couldn't tell whether they had microdosed or not. That's the kind of classic high science called a double blind. So we have very, very simple and just normal, high, classy, salvatory physiological data that says, one, there is an effect separate from the placebo. And the other piece of that study is one of the things that people report is they think better. They're able to think more concretely or abstractly or as they choose. The problem-solving tool. And it turns out that that can be measured as a kind of cognitive flexibility. And it turns out that when you microdose, that capacity is improved as measured up to a certain point. And then that starts to go away. Why, when you're taking more, do you have less cognitive improvement? Well, the term is you start to get high.
And also it's important to know that it's not just this one study by Connor Murray. There are brainwave studies, there are blood flow studies, there are BDNF marker studies for microdosing versus macrodosing. And in all of these cases, microdosing shows the same signature, but at a lower amplitude. So we know that there's really going something on, that there's something going on. And also a fun fact is that a standard microdose of LSD is between, as we talk about it, 7 and 12 micrograms. Each microgram has 1.54 quadrillion, at 16 zeros, molecules of LSD in it. So there's plenty to go around and work with the 40 trillion cells in your body, even at one microgram. So it's not a placebo. And also, just when you look at some of the conditions that we have good evidence for, a lot of it, let's say like depression, the simplest explanation is not that this is a placebo. If you're following Occam's razor, the principle of parsimony, at this point, given Connor's study and these other measurements and just the overwhelming success that people are having, thinking that it's just placebo, it doesn't make any sense. In fact, Connor Murray said, we don't have to talk about this anymore. This is settled. It's not just placebo.
I'd like you to talk about the double-blind, scientific standard tests that have been done thus far, and also talk about the implications of just producing this. When you're making a new medicine, it's really, you'll make a lot of money if your medicine is really new. If you discover a new use for an old medicine, the pharmacological companies are going, well, that's not all that interesting. We can't make that much money on any of this microdosing stuff. So talk about, the economic implications of this study.
Well, if you have something that solves the problem of depression more successfully than antidepressants currently do, it may not be the question of can you make money off of microdosing, because the people who know how to make money will find a way. The question is, does it affect a multi-billion dollar market for a class of pharmaceuticals, which are recognized even by the companies that make them, to not help a certain amount of people and to not help anyone in the best possible way.
And to have side effects that are very damaging often, and that you end up addicted to these substances, you just can't get off of them. So there's a lot of advantages to microdosing. And of course, we would never tell somebody to just stop their pharmaceutical. You have to taper off carefully with the advice of the physician who put you on it. But microdosing supports people in getting off of pharmaceuticals, and might be a better way to go in the first place, because again, it's healing the body. It's not just masking symptoms. It's a big difference.
One of the things that really excited me about this book were the studies to come, I think, that will talk about some of the major bugaboos that are, you know, confronting our society right now. And I'm thinking of dementia and Alzheimer's. It seems like microdosing might have some implications in that area. Have there been studies done? Are there studies being queued up to find out if this is a potential treatment for that?
As of now, there are no studies. And in the book, when we are asked, as you are at the end of such books, what are your predictions? Ho, ho, ho. One of our predictions is that dementia and Alzheimer's will be looked at, because we do have a few reports of people who come out of their fairly advanced dementia and are functioning fairly normally for a few hours. More and more, we're getting more and more questions about that, because people are realizing that if it improves mental functioning, then the question with dementia is, one, have you lost it, or have you simply misplaced it? You know, when you, quote, forget something and then you remember it, well, it was somewhere else in the brain, so to speak, and you found it. So, for example, someone who hadn't spoken for a month or two and is living with his family and being taken care of, he's perfectly affable, smiles, eats, so forth. But his son, who's an important musician, makes an audio tape of old favorites of his father's. And then he microdoses his father. And after a while, the man raises his head. He starts to nod. He starts to go with the music on the beat. He starts, and as his son said, after a few hours, he was remembering lyrics, difficult lyrics from old standards, and singing along with. So what we see in that is a lot of his mind was fine. But the problem clearly in dementia is it was locked in. So that's the kind of experience where if you're a dementia researcher, you would say, I'd like to know more about that. Because none of the people I've ever worked with have had that level of improvement, even if it was only for a few hours.
You know, one of the things you talk about is just how it can help people with their everyday aspects of everyday life, you know, cognitive enhancement, you know, creativity, art, music. So talk about that. And this is where a lot of the really exciting, you know, anecdotes come in.
Sure. I mean, it's in a broad range, but it's not all the way filled in. I think eventually you're going to find people in every artistic, creative, cognitive, and physical and sports-related endeavor. There will be people at the cutting edges of anything you can think of who are using microdosing. For example, we did an interview with Ben Greenfield, a well-known nutritionist and sports guy, and he let us know that ultramarathoners are already clued in and that there are several of them who are definitely using microdosing. And of course, we already talked about the coding thing before, but we get reports about homework is easier and first drafts and writing is easier. And, you know, there's just so many things, it seems. So anything that makes you feel better, anything that increases your neural flexibility through the neuroplasticity, anything that decreases inflammation, all of that is going to support people in doing their best and then being in flow states more often and getting more done.
You know, all of this, how much neuroscience has been done to study the effect of microdosing? Because what you're talking about sounds like, you know, the axons, the things that connect the neurons in our brain, that's where this is affecting, you know, the memory, the ability to, you know, put different thoughts together. It's really, it sounds like it'd be a fascinating place to study this. And how would you go about studying it if you could?
Well, there have been, again, you approach the brain with a certain amount of caution because you're not going to open it up at the end of the study and start measuring. So we do have individual neurons raised in a laboratory. And when you nourish them on something that includes a psychedelic at a low dose, they become more complex. They have more dendrites. They have more endings. They have more ways to communicate. So they're literally physically, and you can kind of see it in the diagram. We have kind of, again, an objective study, which is there's a kind of creepy conventional bit of research, which is how do people react to putting their hands in super ice water? And the question is, how long can you keep your hands in ice water before you pull them out because the pain is too great? Very straightforward. And the way you manipulate it is you feed them something or you deprive them of sleep or whatever. Well, if you measure the effectiveness of pain or lowering the threshold of discomfort, it is better than opiates, which is striking. And there is something that's much better than microdosing, which, except, of course, your experimental subjects then have to sit around for 6 hours and your microdose people go, you know, go out and have lunch. So we're looking both inside the brain where we can, and we're looking at how the brain works as we measure it from the outside. Someone described a lot of neuroscience as putting a stethoscope on the hood of the car and then telling you how the motor is built. So we're not very far in, and neuroscience is really exciting. And there's been lots and lots of studies with high doses. And simply we're finding that microdoses follow along behind those, except where microdoses are more effective.
So it's important to understand that there's two main types of experiments that have shown neuroplasticity is a real thing with psychedelics. The first class is mainly on rodents and rats, and the second class is on human beings. So we know that psychedelics cause actual physical changes to neurons in the brain, as well as functional changes where different genes express or they upregulate other things. So there is a lot going on that we know about for the high doses. And most of what we're seeing, it also seems to be going on with pretty much the same signature, as I said before, but at a lower amplitude. So there's no question that it's really happening. And then we had a really lovely analogy from Andrew Huberman that we borrowed from. Huberman, the science podcaster, had the analogy that when you take a high dose, you're taking a big lever and you're uprooting a boulder that then goes through the village of your mind. And the boulder is the neuroplasticity. So knowing that that's coming, you want to affect where the boulder is going and steer it away from the tents and the farmland, but use it to plow a field. So with microdosing, you're not using the biggest lever, you're using much smaller levers and uprooting a much smaller rock, but it's still rolling through your mind and doing things. But because we're doing it on a pattern, let's say every third day, if you're following Jim's protocol, you have the chance to sort of observe what it does to you and to integrate it and to make use of it and to learn to take best advantage of it.
I recommend a recent publication in the Santa Cruz Outlook, which has an article about our upcoming bookstore appearance and background. But it also has a wonderful story of someone in Santa Cruz and how she uses microdosing in her own life and her own work. And it has one wonderful item, which she said, when I moved from Los Angeles to Santa Cruz, when I moved from an urban environment to a more physically natural environment, I found that it was valuable to lower my microdose. And that's the kind of subtle and sophisticated use that people are learning, which is she was using the microdose to kind of fend off a certain amount of living in Los Angeles that was no longer necessary when she moved to Santa Cruz.
And we're also finding that a lot of people are, over time, reducing their dose. It's almost as if your brain and your mind and your body know where you're going and how to get there. And so you just don't need as much.
And this brings up one of the really interesting points of this book, which is you emphasize that the individuals who are microdosing or those who are interested in using it should listen to their own bodies, to their own reactions, to their own minds, and underestimate to shoot low in terms of dosage. But listen for those little things that will clue you in that the changes that even a small dose that you take that you don't notice taking can make some big changes. And I have to say that You know, when you take an aspirin for a headache, you don't feel some kind of like door opening in your mind or some kind of thing like where the headache just disappears. You just take it, forget about it, and the headache goes away. And I think that the way that microdosing works, it has a lot in common with other medicines. Whatever medicine we take, we don't always think, oh, wow, I'm feeling the effects of whatever medicine I take. We just feel that something goes away or gets better. And that's akin to exactly what's happening with microdosing. So in a sense, it's very much like all the other medicine we take right now and take for granted.
Well, except that almost all the other medicines you're taking are very symptom specific.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we say to people, you know, what's good for everything? And everyone says, nothing is good for everything. Then we say, how about exercise? Oh, yeah, well, that's good for everything. How about better diet? Oh, that's good for everything. How about sleep? Well, that's good for everything. So we're saying now let's look back now at microdosing and see, does it look more like sleep and exercise, or does it look more like an antidepressant or an antispasmodic, or, you know, all the various classes of medicine. Medicine is focused on symptoms. That's just the way it is. It's nothing good or bad about it. Microdosing is improves the functioning of the whole system, often in ways that people didn't anticipate. One of our early discoveries is people would be taking it for a month for whatever reason, and they would say, oh my goodness, as I look back, my sleep pattern has changed, it's improved. I'm eating a better diet. I'm using less cannabis, I'm using less coffee and other kind of special things. And I looked at that and I said, why would someone be having less coffee or less alcohol or less marijuana? I thought, all of those you take in order to shift your awareness, to shift your consciousness, to shift your ability to do whatever it is you either want to do or not want to do. If your state of consciousness is agreeable to you, then you're less likely to reach for a consciousness-changing drug.
You know, that makes perfect sense to me. And one of the things that I like about your book, too, is as you list, there are so many interesting conditions that are amenable to microdosing. Talk about discovering the anecdotes and the people who brought these ideas to you. It must be in a really interesting way of discovering things, new ways that microdosing helps us by hearing new stories from the people who are doing it. This is like a really interesting form of science, I think.
Yeah, it's called observational science or citizen science or the way science, actually the way science was until we had computers that could do all statistical analysis. And how do we get these discoveries? Okay, let me give the one that I thought is the least likely story I could come up with. I get an email from Namibia. Don't worry, most of us don't know where it is either. It's in Africa. I know no one there. Okay, I don't really know where to find it on the map. And he says, I thought you might be interested in the head shingles, which is your childhood chicken pox, reminding you that it's still there. It's a painful adult disease. And he said, and I was in great pain, I was great discomfort. There was no position that I could sleep in that wasn't painful. And I had friends in the capital, and they said, why don't you try these mushrooms? He had no psychedelic experience or interest. He said, within 45 minutes, I felt better. And then he went on to discuss it. And I wrote an email back thanking him very much and asking for more information. And he indicated that when he would feel the initial symptoms of the shingles pain, he would microdose and it would go away. Now, there's no place to put that in a conventional scientific world until we had another couple of shingles people. And what we found out is that shingles, for example, one takes an entirely different protocol than the protocols that we've mentioned so far. So we're still discovering, that's how science really works. Somebody, in this case, someone, you know, from another part of the world, we have reports from 50 countries, and another larger study done by microdose.me had reports from 81 countries. So this is not an unknown. It is around, it is available, and There's 200 species of psilocybin containing mushrooms. They grow on every continent but on Antarctica. So we're dealing with nature and nurture affecting and improving human life as if the mushrooms had some benign and good, you know, plans for us.
So those who don't like what we're doing will dismiss what we've got as having only anecdotes. We prefer to think of it as real-world evidence. And at the start of the science chapter, we quote Jeff Bezos, who says, if your data and your anecdotes disagree, your anecdotes are usually right. And it's not so much that you've mismeasured your data, it's that you're asking the wrong question. So when we have these stories coming in, and by the way, our website, which is Microdosing Book, one word, microdosingbook.com, we have a place for people to put news stories and send them to us. And we're getting some amazing stories already. So where the rubber hits the road on this is that after the thalidomide disaster around the world, although it wasn't released in the United States, there was legislation here that came in and made the double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized study the gold standard. That's the thing that has to be satisfied, according to the government now, in order for it to be real. But the problem is that with psychedelics, it's very hard to blind things effectively. And so they're sort of giving us an impossible test that we in part can't satisfy. And so getting people to understand that for hundreds of years, people have been taking substances and comparing notes with each other and figuring out what the effects are and what's safe and what it's good for or not. We've been doing this for hundreds of years, literally, and we've basically resumed this tradition. And as more and more science does come in, you know, that everybody agrees is counts, we're going to see it just, you know, agreeing with where we've already been going.
I'm wondering if you guys could talk. Almost all microdosing, as I understand it, is split between LSD and psilocybin-containing mushrooms. But there are other substances. You mentioned ayahuasca, and there's the Amanita mushroom. So would you talk about both of those?
We try not to, but
okay.
We will. The reason is very simple. Amanita, Christmas mushroom, you've all seen the pictures, red with white spots, is a very powerful and effective consciousness changer. It also seems to have a lot of healing properties, but it needs to be prepared well, which means you can't pick it, dry it, and eat it. That's just not the way the substance exists. So it has many more kind of warnings around it. So we're going easy on it. And there is one book out about microdosing with Amanita muscaria, work done in Russia, which if someone was serious, they should look at. The ayahuasca is actually used as a microdose throughout South America. There's a wonderful group in Peru, and they, with Shabibo shamans in preparing the medicine, and then it is used as a microdose for a host of different uses. And they train counselors and coaches, many of whom are licensed therapists, to work with microdoses in that way. So there are other substances, and there will be other substances. Our book, being based on what other people have told us, is limited primarily to the 95% of abusers who use LSD or psilocybin. Does that cover it, Jordan?
Well, there. You know, the thing about the ayahuasca is it has two components. It has a vine, which is called Banisteriopsis caapi, and then they add another component, which has DMT in it. So the vine itself is legal. You can even buy it here in the United States, and that alone works pretty well as a microdosing agent. You don't have to add in the very illegal DMT component. And then there's other situations like San Pedro cactus. You can extract huachuma, which is a type of mescaline, from it. It's not legal to extract it and use it, but it's legal to own the plant in your backyard. And similarly, while we're kind of talking about this, you know, what we tell most people who are interested is to look up a local psychedelic society or meet a group or organization. They're not hard to find if you go online at all. And if you ask around, there's usually people who will be able to help. And another option is to grow your own mushrooms. Back in the 70s, it was almost impossible to succeed. By now, they have these grow kits that make it much, much easier to grow your own mushrooms, and then you become your own trusted source, basically.
Could you guys talk about, the feeling of taking this message, which is very important to the world, and using this book and your websites and your shows like Bookshop Santa Cruz to, present and try to offer people, something that could really help them and also to offer it to them in a way that's safe and effective.
I mean, how do you change the world? Yeah. Is that the question? one dose at a time.
Easier said than done.
Well, basically what you see is cultures move slowly, and certain parts of the culture move more slowly than others. And in the United States, the Food and Drug Administration is right up there with slowest possible. So remember, you're dealing with a substance which was made illegal, not for medical and not for psychological reasons at all, but by President Nixon needing some people to attack and arrest groups he didn't like, which included hippies, people who didn't like the war, blacks, and so forth. So it never had a reason to be illegal. And when it was made illegal, it's called Schedule One, new creation of the Nixon administration, which says no medical uses and high possibility for addiction. Okay. Now, then they threw things in there that didn't fit at all. But the wonderful thing about psychedelics, high dose, low dose, any dose, is they're anti-addictive. If you take it too often, it simply stops working. Okay. And if you take a whole lot more, it still stops working. So it's anti-addictive.
And this is one of the interesting aspects that something that this book tells me that I never knew, which is that psychedelics have no physical, they don't harm you physically, and they go out of your body, pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And microdosing seems like a fairly sensible way to approach them.
Well, when you look at toxicity of substances, what kills people, and that you see the list, and it starts always with tobacco and alcohol, and then the little bars get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, and way down at the bottom is usually psychedelics, very often with no fatalities ever. So that's a kind of measure of safety. And microdoses are safer than that. So we're not dealing with something that's too, that has physiological concerns.
And to loop back to your question about changing the world, when you realize that microdoses in particular have such a high reward to risk ratio, if it doesn't work for you, you just stop and nothing has happened to you. It's sort of a no harm, no foul. When you think of conditions like ADHD, the United States government says it's okay for three-year-olds to be on Adderall. There's about 80,000 three-year-olds on this addictive pharmaceutical that has side effects. Why not find a way to think about maybe we don't have to go to Adderall right away, and there might be natural substances that people have been using for tens or hundreds of thousands of years that might strengthen and heal the body and make a difference without having to hit three-year-olds with the pharmaceutical. When people hear that about three-year-olds, a lot of them shake their head and go, yeah, we really need to do something. So I think as it becomes clear that for depression, for ADHD, for chronic pain, I mean, when you read the list of everything we know about and all the ones, some of them we only have a few cases for and we don't have a strong sense, but there's a bunch that we know. Migraine headaches and cluster headaches are both, a lot better. Not all the way healed, not that you never get them again, but a lot better. When you look at all of these things and you look at that very high reward to risk ratio, you got to really be more skeptical about pharmaceuticals.
So the world is changing, and when you write something, by the time it's published, the world has already moved ahead of you. So when we started to write this book, microdosing was of considerable interest, and there was a little bit of science, and most articles said, well, there's not much science. Over half the science that's ever been done on microdosing was done in the last year and a half while we were writing the book. That's just a piece. The other is what happens. What about curiosity? Well, we have this wonderful curiosity measure called Google search. So how many people search for the word microdosing? And if you look at the curve, it kind of goes up and up and up and up a little bit, and then it swoops up in the last year or two. And there were 3 million searches last year for the word microdosing. So the world is changing, and not surprisingly, science and commerce are racing to catch up.
The new book by James Fadiman and Jürgen Gruber is Microdosing. They'll be at Bookshop Santa Cruz. talk a little bit about the presentation you're going to make. When's it going to happen and what you're going to talk about?
It'll be March 2nd at 4 o'clock at Bookshop Santa Cruz. We'll be talking pretty much about what we're talking about now. You know, we like to say what microdosing is and how it differs from large doses and what the general set of benefits are. And then hopefully we'll have a bit of question and answer at the end.
Well, that sounds great. Thank you for joining me, James and Jürgen. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.